The reoccurrence of anti-industrialism in Lord of the Rings has been singled out for attention by several critics. Roger Sale observed that Tolkien has always spoken as though only fools and madmen would contemplate the 20th century without horror. On a more positive note, Paul Coker wrote that Tolkien was ecologist, champion of the extraordinary, hater of progress, lover of handicrafts, detester of war long before such attitudes became fashionable. Although such attitudes were certainly fashionable in 1972 when Coker wrote these lines, and were about to become even more so in the following publication during the following year of E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, it would be inaccurate to suggest that Tolkien was ahead of his time. He was, in fact, merely following a long tradition of opposition to the evils of the Industrial Age, stretching back to William Blake and William Cobbett almost two centuries earlier, to the very dawn of industrialism itself.
Very interesting.
All right, Clifford, back again for another one. First one in a long while.
Yes. So this is chapter 9 of book 2 of Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
What's the name of this chapter?
Flotsam and Jetsam.
Oh, right. Flotsam and Jetsam. Chapter 9 of book 2.
Yep.
Well, technically the third book of the Two Towers.
I think they're probably paying attention.
I know. Yeah. Okay, so Gandalf, Théoden, and the
Men
of
Rohan.
All
right, so another pretty standard chapter where we'll mostly just go through it. Kind of chronological order, I guess. There's a couple things that I got a note from chapter 8 that I forgot. And yeah, we'll talk about what Merry and Pippin have been up to since we last saw them back in chapter 4. And actually, we saw them last chapter, but whatever, you know. We only saw him at the tail end. And then we'll talk about how the Ents have come to take over Isengard. And, yeah, big conversations about what's kind of like the deeper meaning of that. And, yeah, and then we'll kind of just wrap up. All right, so this is pretty standard. About as standard episode as it can get. Who knows if we can make it long, but
we'll do our best.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, Clifford, bring on Cliff's notes.
Okay. So Gandalf, Théoden, and the Men of Rohan venture to the other side of Isengard to find Treebeard, but Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn stay behind with Merry and Pippin, eager to hear what has transpired since they saw them last, and pursued them for 3 days. Merry and Pippin recount their capture by the orcs, their fateful escape, and their meeting of Treebeard. They go on to describe the destruction of Isengard by the Ents, performed while the Battle of Helm's Deep was raging.
Alright, okay, so, before we go, I accidentally put a couple of the notes about hobbits and their connection with Rohan in this chapter because when I was quickly making these outlines, like literally a year or more ago, mm-hmm. I guess when I was like reading the books and then putting the notes together, I thought it happened in this chapter. I forgot it was at the end of the last chapter. So I had some notes about Merry and Théoden interacting. There's another place to put a lot of them. But the ones they were talking about hobbit smoke, in the drafts, that conversation was originally a lot longer, but they moved most of the stuff to the prologue. That's where it's basically lots of stuff that was in that pipeweed section in the prologue. You remember that? It was originally here. But it's still it's worth the read. And by this point, we're now on History of Middle Earth, Part 8, The War of the Rings. So it's in there. It's worth a read. It's pretty funny. Théoden says something like, in the Far East, uncouth men drink smoke, or so I have heard. And it is said wizards do also.
What does that mean?
Isn't hookah where you drink smoke?
Oh, okay. Like
I think
bong.
I think it's that.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay. Oh, the other thing. We probably should have talked about last chapter, but we might as well just do it here. But we've already kind of talked about it in chapter 4. Orthanc. We already got a description of Orthanc last chapter, but it comes from... Remember when we were talking about the origins of the word Ent, and we kind of decided Ent is usually translated as giant whenever it was seen in Old English?
Okay, right, right.
And they were the ones that thought, like, they built all these huge Roman structures. You know, the Anglo-Saxons thought they did.
Right, because remember, the Anglo-Saxons are the people basically coming upon an abandoned Roman Britain.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there was that one line, Orthanc enta gwecorc, which means cunning work of giants. So that's where Orthanc comes from. You know, giants would have made Orthanc. So this makes sense because the original idea was that the Ents were going to be bad guys, and it was Treebeard that had captured Gandalf and Orthanc. Like, that was the original idea. And then he created Saruman later and then had him be in charge of Orthanc. And the trees are a form of giants. They're just, you know, he makes them kind of nature giants, and then they're good guys. So.
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay, so we cover that. And with that, I think let's jump into the chapter.
Okay. Gandalf and the king's company rode away, turning eastward to make the circuit of the ruined walls of Isengard. But Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas remained behind. Leaving Arad and Hasselfel to stray in search of grass, they came and sat beside the hobbits.
"Well, well, the hunt is over, and we meet again at last, where none of us ever thought to come," said Aragorn.
"And now that the Great Ones have gone to discuss high matters," said Legolas, "the hunters can perhaps learn the answers to their own small riddles. We tracked you as far as the forest, but there are still many things that I should like to know the truth of."
"And there is a great deal, too, that we want to know about you," said Merry. "We have learnt a few things through Treebeard, the old Ent, but he is not nearly enough."
"All in good time," said Legolas. "We were the hunters, and you should give an account of yourselves to us first."
"Or second," said Gimli. "It would be better after a meal." So they're going to go eat a meal at this point, but I love that line, Aragorn's first line there, where it was, "Well, here we are. None of us wanted to be here. We all meet right where we don't want to be, but look at this situation. Who could have expected this?" Kind of fun.
Right, right.
Yeah. And then this also, just the idea of Gandalf and the king, and what did Legolas say? The great ones to discuss high matters have gone elsewhere. Mm-hmm. This totally, totally feels like a huge family Christmas party where, you know, yep. you go and you do the introductions with everybody, and then all the kids go down into the basement to just hang out, like, right after that was all done, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. And it's funny because clearly Aragorn, we know, is an important guy, and right. Legolas and Gimli are not unimportant themselves, but they're hanging out with the teenagers, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It's always
while
always
the old
fun.
Men are off across on the other side of Isengard.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so at this point, they go to the guardhouse. Men worked this guardhouse, so it wasn't orcs. And then the hobbits found...
Just to orient ourselves a little bit, this is...
It's on the wall.
This is in the wall of the...
The circular wall.
Right, the massive circular... It was like a circular fortress wall around Isengard, around Orthanc, and it's been partially destroyed by the Ents, right? And they flooded the inside of this giant circular wall, and now in the ruins of this wall, there's the guardhouse that used to be over one of the main gates, right?
Yeah, I think it was in the gate.
Okay.
You know, like, it's a really thick wall. Like, they had
some sort of kind of monumental arch type thing.
Yeah, maybe. There's buildings throughout, you know? You know, ancient cities had houses in the wall.
Yeah.
Jericho in the Bible, where it came down. Yeah. Okay, anyways. They find toast, wine, beer, salted pork for him. Obviously, that's so important. Well, the salted pork, that's the classic movie line, so. And then, let's see, what's next?
The three were soon busy with their meal, and the two hobbits, unabashed, set to a second time.
"We must keep our guests company," they said.
"You were full of courtesy this morning," laughed Legolas. "But maybe, if we had not arrived, you would already have been keeping one another company again."
"Maybe, maybe not," said Pippin. "We had foul fare with the orcs, and little enough for days before that. It seems a long while since we could eat to our heart's content."
"It does not seem to have done you any harm," said Aragorn. "Indeed, you look in the bloom of health."
"Aye, you do indeed," said Gimli, looking them up and down over the top of his cup. "Why, your hair is twice as thick and curly as when we parted, and I swear you have both grown somewhat, if that is possible for hobbits of your age. This tree beard, at any rate, has not starved you."
He is not, said Merry, but Ents only drink, and drink is not enough for content. Treebeard's draughts may be nourishing, but one feels the need of something solid, and even Lembas is none the worse for a change.
You've drunk of the water of the Ents, have you? Said Legolas. Ah, I think, then, that Gimli's eyes do not deceive him. Strange songs have been sung of the draughts of Fangorn.
Many strange tales have been told about that land, said Aragorn. I have never entered it. Come, tell me more about it, and about the Ents.
Ents, said Pippin. Ents are all different for one thing, but their eyes now, they are very odd. He tried a few fumbling words that trailed off into silence. Oh well, he went on, you have seen some at a distance already. They saw you at any rate and reported that you were on your way, and you will see many others, I expect, before you leave here. You must form your own ideas. Funny line that the hobbits sit down for a second meal. Typical, yeah. Classic.
Right. Right. But they're still certainly enjoying themselves. They're kicked back in their new living room, basically.
Yeah. And then, okay, so then Legolas basically all but confirms, yeah, there is something in the water of the Ents. Like, that's common knowledge among the elves, I guess. Because they're taller and healthier. Then the Ents' eyes. I always think those are cool descriptions, even though Pippin can't describe them. But
yeah, Pippin's a little bit lost, but I think we got a description earlier on when they first looked into the eyes of the Ents, but it's not explicitly like they're beautiful. It's kind of haunting almost. Pippin's
not haunting. What's the word? Mesmerizing or
yeah, he's more just shocked. He's silenced by how unique it is, I guess, to look into them.
Yeah, mesmerizing / moving. Whatever the word is, that's a combination of the two. Anyways, so it looks like Merry and Pippin, they found Longbottom leaf pipeweed here. And so Longbottom's a town in the Shire, and it produces the best pipeweed in all of the Shire. And that's according to Merry and Pippin, who would know. So, and then they said it even has the Hornblower brand marks. I think that's the family that makes it, the Hobbit family. Mm-hmm. On the barrels. Plain as plain. How it came here, I can't imagine. For Saruman's private use, I fancy. I never knew it went so far abroad, but it comes in handy now. And then Pippin, there's a little scene where Pippin has an extra pipe for Gimli, because they're good friends. But then again, I was wondering, is sharing a pipe like sharing like a toothbrush?
Well, he's got an extra one, right? He's got a spare. They're not using the same one.
Okay.
I think better than sharing a toothbrush.
All right. Let's just go on. Okay. So they go back outside to sit on the stones. Aragorn actually totally lays out, looks rested, and Merry thinks he looks again like Strider as he was laying out in Bree, you know?
Mm-hmm. Which is like, I don't know, coming full circle in a way from the kingly side of Aragorn that we've seen in the past couple chapters.
Yeah, or if not full circle, just good memories
reflection back to what they once knew him as,
and it probably wasn't fond at the time, but it's probably a fond memory to see him like that now,
right?
I would guess. Okay, and so now here we've already talked about this a lot, so I'm just going to point out that we're doing it again, or that Tolkien's doing it again. Pippin and Merry are going to start to recall all the events that have happened to them for the past it sounds like it's only been 9 days since Boromir died, which sounds about right, and Tolkien would know because he diligently compiled this.
That is astounding, because think of all the chapters we've had between there and all that's happened. But yeah, 9 days, not much at all.
Right. So this goes back to the idea that interlacing, the weaving of the threads, you know, each storyline's kind of a thread, and then you weave them all together and you get the saga and the Icelandic words, whatever they were.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so we talked about that multiple times already. We'll continue to talk about it. Just point it out here, and now we can actually get into what they said. So Pippin starts with waking up in the orc scrum. Again, like we said, that was 9 days ago. So they spent 3 of the days with the orcs. They recounted Boromir's fight with the orcs. Aragorn matched all his guesses to their story, which again, as we said, they were too perfect. Aragorn was too good at that to where it wasn't even, there was no suspense, you know.
Right.
And Aragorn, he returned the Lorien daggers that they had and Pippin's brooch. Gimli, cutting the bands of your wrists. That was smart work. Luck served you there, but you seized your chance with both hands, one might say. So again, we could probably spend, I don't know, 15 minutes talking about just that line itself. But we see luck there, but also, you know, seizing your chance with both hands. You're taking the initiative.
Right, right.
Obviously, luck's involved, and by luck, that's usually providence in this book, but the characters themselves still have to act. Aragorn uneasy about how much Mordor orcs knew already. Yeah, that was a kind of a big deal, too. Aragorn thought it was weird how knowledgeable all the orcs were. Like, the one knew about the ring already, you know, right. Clearly.
No, knew about hobbits, knew about the ring.
Yeah, yeah, and then...
Already had plans.
Right, and Aragorn had said, but he goes on and said, all right, Saruman was probably the real problem. And Mary just goes and says, yeah, you know, he's probably not a problem anymore. Saruman, any way you slice it, he's in deep shit. So...
But basically Aragorn is, he's taken aback by how much Sauron seemed to be seeing from afar, basically.
Sauron or Saruman?
Sauron.
Oh.
He's, is that the implication?
No, he's just, I think he's more worried about, oh, maybe, but I think just the orcs all knowing it too. Maybe that's such common knowledge among the orcs.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, there's two different, we'll have to see.
Okay.
Maybe we'll meet more orcs in this book.
Almost certainly. Basically, Aragorn's, he feels, even though this is a moment of rejoice, or not gloating, but they're sitting on the spoils, they're eating the spoils of victory right now.
It's a high moment. Yeah.
It's a high point.
Yeah.
We're reminded that there's a larger battle going on, and Aragorn is like a little on the back foot about this.
Yeah.
What's going on right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Gimli mentions that they think they saw Saruman, and that was 5 nights ago, which leads into Merry's line on 550.
Let me see, said Merry. 5 nights ago. Now we come to a part of the story you know nothing about. We met Treebeard that morning after the battle, and that night we were at Welling Hall, one of his Ent houses. The next morning we went to Entmoot, a gathering of Ents, that is, and the queerest thing I have ever seen in my life. It lasted all that day and the next. We spent the nights with an Ent called Quickbeam. And then late in the afternoon, in the third day of their moot, the Ents suddenly blew up. It was amazing. The forest had felt as tense as if a thunderstorm was brewing inside it. Then all at once it exploded. I wish you could have heard their song as they marched.
If Saruman had heard it, he would be 100 miles away by now. Even if he had had to run on his own legs, said Pippin. Though Isengard be strong and hard, as cold as stone and bare as bone, we go to war to hew the stone and break the door. There was much more. A great deal of the song had no words, and was like a music of horn and drums. It was very exciting. But I thought it was only marching music, and no more, just a song, until I got here. I know better now.
We came down over the last ridge into Nan Cúrinir, after night had fallen. Mary continued. It was then that I first had the feeling that the forest itself was moving behind us. I thought I was dreaming and Entis dream, but Pippin noticed it too. We were both frightened, but we did not find out more about it until later. It was the Huorns, which... Excuse me. It was the Huorns, or so the Ents call them in short language. Treebeard won't say much about them, but I think they are Ents that have become almost like trees, at least to look at it. They stand here and there in the woods, or under its eaves, silent, watching endlessly over the trees, but deep in the darkest dales there are hundreds and hundreds of them, I believe. There is great power in them, and they seem to be able to wrap themselves in shadow. It is difficult to see them moving, but they do. They can move very quickly if they are angry. You stand still, looking at the weather, maybe, or listening to the rustling of the wind, and then suddenly you find that you are in the middle of a wood with great groping trees all around you. They still have voices, and can speak with the Ents. That is why they are called Huorns, Treebeard says. But they have become queer and wild, dangerous. I should be terrified of meeting them, if there were no true Ents about to look after them. Well, in the early night we crept down a long ravine to the upper end of the Wizard's Vale, the Ents with all their rustling Huorns behind. We could not see them, of course, but the whole air was full of creaking. It was a very dark, cloudy night. They moved at a great speed as soon as they had left the hills, and made a noise like a rushing wind. The moon did not appear through the clouds, and not long after midnight there was a tall wood all round the north side of Isengard. There was no sign of enemies, nor of any challenge. There was a slight gleaming from a high window in the tower, that was all. Treebeard and a few more Ents crept on, right round to within sight of the great gates. Pippin and I were with him. We were sitting on Treebeard's shoulders, and I could feel the quivering tenseness in him. But even when they are roused, Ents can be very cautious and patient. They stood still as carved stones, breathing and listening.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, so, I don't know. We're not going to read all of this, just the most interesting parts to highlight. At this point, the whole orc army moves out. It's a 10,000 strong to destroy Rohan. It takes about an hour. Merry and Aragorn talk about the orc men. Some look like the southerner that was in Bree. Do you remember him? He's got kind of weird eyes. Kind of.
Right. It seems they like described him as swarthy.
Yeah, or a crossbreed almost. Some kind of like half man, half orc or something.
Okay.
Which is an idea that's not really fleshed out in Lord of the Rings, but he does flesh it out somewhere else, and it's kind of weird.
Okay.
I think we'll talk about it at some point.
Okay. We'll keep it in mind.
Yeah. But we can keep going. We're just going to blow through, you know, some plot stuff here so that we're just better prepared to, I don't know, give our thoughts on the one part. Mm-hmm. Like I said, this is a pretty standard chapter, so you want to take Merry again?
They were all singing with harsh voices, they being the orcs and men marching out of Isengard. They were all singing with harsh voices and laughing, making a hideous din. I thought things looked very black for Rohan, but Treebeard did not move. He said, "My business is with Isengard tonight, with rock and stone." But though I could not see what was happening in the dark, I believe that the Hurons began to move south as soon as the gates were shut again. Their business was with the orcs, I think. They were down, far down in the valley in the morning, or at any rate there was a shadow there that one couldn't see through. As soon as Saruman had sent off all his army, our turn came. Treebeard put us down, and went up to the gates and began hammering on the doors and calling for Saruman. There was no answer except arrows and stones from the walls. But arrows are no use against Ents. They hurt them, of course, and infuriate them, like stinging flies. But an Ent can be stuck as full of orc arrows as a pincushion, and take no serious harm. They cannot be poisoned, for one thing, and their skins seem to be very thick, and tougher than bark. It takes a very heavy axe stroke to wound them seriously. They don't like axes. But there would have to be a great many axemen to one Ent. A man that hacks once at an Ent never gets a chance of a second blow. A punch from an Ent fist crumples up iron like thin tin. When Treebeard had got a few arrows in him, he began to warm up, to get positively hasty, as he would say. He let out a great hum-hum, and a dozen more Ents came striding up. An angry Ent is terrifying. Their fingers and their toes just freeze on to rock, and they tear it up like bread crust. It was like watching the work of great tree roots in 100 years, all packed into a few moments. They pushed, pulled, tore, shook, and hammered, and clang-bang, crash-crack, in 5 minutes they had these huge gates just lying in ruin. And some were already beginning to eat into the walls, like rabbits in a sand pit. I don't know what Saruman thought was happening, but anyway, he did not know how to deal with it. His wizardry may have been falling off lately, of course, but anyways, I think he has not much grit, not much plain courage alone in a tight place without a lot of slaves and machines and things, if you know what I mean. Very different from our old Gandalf. I wonder if his fame was not all along mainly due to his cleverness in settling in Isengard.
No, said Aragorn. Once he was as great as his fame made him. His knowledge was deep, his thought was subtle, and his hands marvelously skilled, and he had a power over the minds of others. The wise he could persuade, and the smaller folk he could daunt. That power he certainly still keeps. There are not many in Middle-earth that I would say were safe, if they were left alone to talk with him. Even now, when he has suffered a defeat. Gandalf, Elrond, and Galadriel, perhaps, now that his wickedness has been laid bare, but very few others. All right, so a couple things there. One of the books pointed out that there's starting to be a change here where the hobbits themselves are more kind of knowledgeable or giving input / analysis on stuff. Like they're not just saying, you know, not just recounting stuff.
Mm-hmm. They're also, they're less observers to all the stuff happening around them as they were in the beginning and now are not only active participants but also smart enough to be kind of active.
Right. Well, yeah, usually it's Aragorn that's piecing together the background stuff, but now Merry was doing a solid job there himself as well.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Oh, the part where they describe it, how it was like watching the work of great tree roots in 100 years, all packed into a few moments. Oh, one of my favorite ideas of the whole trilogy is how the Ents. We'll talk about it in a little bit, but they're doing what trees do. You know, I mean, this is real. If you walk down a sidewalk somewhere, you're going to see a tree roots lifted up over the past 20 years of growing. So pretty cool that this can just be applied to destroying a whole evil stronghold.
Be real, the force of nature growing is tremendous. A friend told me recently that the amount of force, just from a physics standpoint, that a peach, which you think of as being so soft and delicate, mm-hmm. that like a peach growing exerts something like 10,000 pounds of force outwards, just extremely slowly.
Really?
It grows outwards. Yeah, it was some ridiculous number like that. Like, how could you think a peach would be so strong? But it's just the force of a tree wanting to expand something,
mm-hmm.
and particularly its roots, is just like, it will destroy just about anything.
Yeah.
So I agree. That was a great analogy.
Okay, so how about one more big section, and then by that point, we'll not just keep reading the chapter for you.
Yes, yeah. And I opening up right here, take note of just exactly what Patrick was saying, of Pippin actually offering some of his own insight and analysis.
Yeah.
In response to Gandalf saying, only a few in Middle-earth, like Gandalf, Elrond, Galadriel, could stand up to the wickedness of Sauron, of Saruman speaking to them, of persuading the wise.
The Ents are safe, said Pippin. He seems at one time to have got around them, but never again. And anyways, he did not understand them, and he made the great mistake of leaving them out of his calculations. He had no plan for them, and there was no time to make any, once they had set to work. As soon as our attack began, the few remaining rats in Isengard started bolting through every hole that the Ents made. The Ents let the men go, after they had questioned them, 2 or 3 dozen only down at this end. I don't think many orc folk of any size escaped. Not from the hewers. There was a whole wood full of them all around Isengard by that time, as well as those that had gone down the valley. When the Ents had reduced a large part of the southern walls to rubbish, and what was left of his people had bolted and deserted him, Saruman fled in panic. He seems to have been at the gates when we arrived. I expect he came to watch his splendid army march out. When the Ents broke their way in, he left in a hurry. They did not spot him at first, but the night had opened out, and there was great light of stars, quite enough for Ents to see by, and surely Quickbeam gave a cry. The tree killer! The tree killer! Quickbeam is a gentle creature, but he hates Saruman all the more fiercely for that. His people suffered cruelly from orc axes. He leapt down the path from the inner gate, and he can move like the wind when he is roused. There was a plain figure hurrying in and out of the shadows of pillars, and it nearly reached the stairs of the tower door. But it was a near thing. Quickbeam was so hot after him that he was within a step or two of being caught and strangled when he slipped in through the door. When Saruman was safe back in Orthanc, it was not long before he set some of his precious machinery to work. By that time, there were many Ents inside Isengard. Some followed Quickbeam, and others had burst in from north and east. They were roaming about and doing a great deal of damage. Suddenly, up came fires and foul fumes. The vents and shafts of all over the plain began to spout and belch. Several of the Ents got scorched and blistered. One of them, Beachbone, I think he was called, a very tall, handsome Ent, got in a spray of some liquid fire and burned like a torch. A horrible sight. That sent them mad. I thought they were already really roused before, but I was wrong. I saw what it was like at last. It was staggering. They roared and boomed and trumpeted, until stones began to crack and fall at the mere noise of them. Mary and I lay on the ground and stuffed our cloaks into our ears. Round and round the rock of Orthanc, the Ents went striding and storming like a howling gale, breaking pillars, hurling avalanches of boulders down the shafts, tossing up huge slabs of stone into the air like leaves. The tower was in the middle of a spinning whirlwind. I saw iron posts and blocks of masonry go rocketing up hundreds of feet and smash against the windows of Orthanc. But Treebeard kept his head. He had not had any burns, luckily. He did not want his folk to hurt themselves in their fury, and he did not want Saruman to escape out of some hole in the confusion. Many of the Ents were hurling themselves against the Orthanc rock, but that defeated them. It is very smooth and hard. Some wizardry is in it, perhaps, older and stronger than Saruman's. Anyways, they could not get a grip on it, or make a crack in it, and they were bruising and wounding themselves against it. Treebeard went out into the ring and shouted. His enormous voice rose above all the din. There was a dead silence suddenly. In it we heard a shrill laugh from a high window in a tower. That had a queer effect on the Ents. They had been boiling over. Now they became cold, grim as ice, and quiet. They left the plain and gathered around Treebeard, standing quite still. He spoke to them for a little in their own language. I think he was telling of a plan he had made in his old head long before. Then they just faded silently away into the gray light. Day was dawning by that time.
Okay.
The Pretty
destruction
cool.
of Isengard.
Yeah. So, we already know about the trees moving. That was originally inspired by Macbeth, right? We don't have to talk about that again.
This does clarify things a little bit, because we know that there's Ents We know that there's trees. We knew that there were trees down by Helm's Deep.
Right.
We knew that Merry and Pippin were with Ents, and it was all clear that something like was animating the forest, but it wasn't clear to me, at least, that, you know, are these a bunch of Ents down by Helm's Deep? What's going on? And this whole sequence for us is clarified. There's some sort of in-between species that's not quite tree, not quite Ent, called the Hjorns, that sound a little more volatile and a little more wild than the Ents. That's what we saw at Helm's Deep, and that's like the maybe the second line in the attack on Isengard. It sounds like they've got Isengard surrounded, and then the Ents are the active ones doing the destruction, and the Hjorns are there. The Hjorns are there catching the orcs as they flee, basically.
Right. Well, we'll remember from the Helm's Deep chapter, or the Road to Isengard, the last chapter, when they walk through, there were about three or four Ents with the Hjorns that went to Helm's Deep, because they literally did act as their shepherds, but Legolas was freaking out when he saw him, remember? But yeah, so here, though, this is mostly the Ents inside the ring, and then the Hjorns, you know, if anybody's lucky enough to escape, they're not lucky, because they're going to get messed up. So.
Right.
Any other thoughts, your take, before I go into the big set of notes here?
I mean, nothing much more than this sounds super cool. This is what one of my favorite sequences, I think, in the whole series is the Ents going to war and destroying Isengard.
Yeah, the movie does a pretty good job with it, too.
Yeah, you know, agreed.
If you're wondering. We've already seen with the elves, we've talked about them and their, in quotes, magical powers. Try to make the case that they're not quite magical. It seems magical to us, but for the elves, they wouldn't consider it any sort of magic. It's just kind of their natural God-given abilities, right?
Right.
So not so here at Isengard. Probably if you ask medieval people to, you know, name magic, Isengard would be magical to them, and this would be an evil magic. This would be bad magic. So this is potentially the first time we've really encountered magic in this trilogy, and it's something that probably doesn't seem that all that magical to us. But anyways, it's because of this machinery and this all this whole kind of huge factory system that Saruman set up.
Right. Mines.
Right.
Yeah. Production lines of some sort.
Because he's created all this stuff in order to basically dominate not only other people, but also nature as well. So when you create these kinds of powerful things, and, you know, now you really are kind of creating an unnatural power, and that would be considered magic for a lot of people. So medieval times, you know, what they would normally be thinking of is kind of something like alchemy or some sort of thing where, you know, you make some elixir of life, you know, to give you immortality. Those are the big magical things in the Middle Ages, right? And alchemy, just to be clear, that's the typical thing, is where you take some sort of metal and you can figure out how to turn it into gold, right?
Right. The elixir of life also is like the other big one.
Right. Yeah. So those are the two bad magics in the Middle Ages. Now, today, those actually kind of exist today. Well, not quite exist today, but there's offshoots of them that are real today. You know, like you can definitely make the case that people and corporations, some of them, they, especially in a digital age of money, they are almost making money out of thin air, you know, creating wealth, whether it's illegal or by theft. That's one way. The other thing, they would actually probably have said this in the Middle Ages, or the most, I don't know, most morally upright people, who are almost like too upright to even be practical, they probably didn't like interest rates. Like, they would have called that usury, you know, and that was bad. Because that's not really a natural thing either. You're creating something out of nothing, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Especially back then, there was no time value money, you know? You charged an interest rate because you charge a high interest rate, partly as protection for yourself, but also because, you weren't expecting to get your whole loan back, you know, because they probably didn't get those paid back, you know.
Right. I mean, that was, stop me if this is too much of a diversion. That's like the origins of capitalism as we know it today is like people being able to give loans on things and project into the future and understand that they can take a gamble and then get their money back. That's like for better or for worse, that unlocks a huge amount of potential in Europe at late Middle Ages. Like, once people are able to do that, that's like you can work off of this imaginary money that's going to come to you in the future.
Credit. No, but they knew that in the Middle Ages. It just didn't work out. Like, right. They didn't have the confidence that they would actually get it back, you know.
Fair.
By around the Enlightenment time, that's when it's reliable enough that they can get it back. Maybe because they charged reasonable interest rates. because I think it was crazy stuff in the Middle Ages where it's just, you're a jerk. What are you doing? Anyways, okay. So these are still all kind of forms of, kind of falls into that similar to that alchemy category, you know? The Elixir of Life one too. Anyways, for today examples, you see tons of companies and pharmacies and everything. They're creating all sorts of drugs that either help you kind of stop aging or extend your life, you know, in their quest for immortality, which, spoiler alert, they won't achieve. So, but anyways, a huge industrial factory, it devours the whole landscape around it, and its product is making a vast army that destroys everything else, you know, around it too. This will fit into this magical categories, you know, it'll kind of like the alchemy a little bit, you know, it's not like they're turning metal into gold, but you know, you use the gold so that you can have wealth, which gets you power. He's just creating power here, you know, very unnatural ways. And so obviously Isengard's extreme example of this bad magic, you know, again, it doesn't feel like magic to us, right?
right we understand it as technology and science and those types of things, just the world we live in, basically.
Obviously Isengard extreme example, but that's what fantasy always deals with, is extreme examples. And yeah, and then this chapter, though, the fun part of this is, okay, well, there's consequences for your actions here. This is where we see nature gets to strike back. What we probably all have to, you know, every human society or good human society, especially going forward, we gotta, not to say like anybody's ever gonna be perfect at this or good at this even, but you know, this is something to strive for, is when we create any sort of like new technology and as we expand and grow, we should probably recognize that there's natural limits along the way, you know, that constrain us, right? Because that's kind
of, yeah, absolutely,
that's been the problem. This doesn't feel weird to us because in like the modern world, we haven't acted like there's constraints.
Yeah, exactly. The past, I don't know, 100, 200 years is like unconstrained.
Right.
But that book you mentioned at the beginning as part of the quote, the I think it was
small,
I don't remember which, small is better or Small Planet. There were like three books that all came around at the same time, right? Right around 1970.
Small is beautiful.
Small is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were, I mean, it was early environmentalism that was like, you know, you don't have to be a tree hugger or something and be totally in love with nature to look at the problem of we're expanding and we're on a planet where things are finite. Like,
right.
We're gonna max it out pretty soon, and now we're seeing we in a lot of ways have already maxed out a lot of things, and we're pushing the boundaries of what the Earth can handle right now. And on the one hand, you know, this is my own feeling, like we kind of like pity the Earth for like how bad we've pushed, how many forests we've cut down, that type of thing. But also, there's this aspect that Tolkien's talking about here. It's like, if you have the hubris to think that you conquered nature in any of these constructions, like you're bound to be proved wrong at some point, because nature claps back with like tremendous power sooner or later. And that's kind of what's going on with the Ents here.
Right. Well, Pippin also pointed out that Saruman didn't account for that or expect that. Like, this took him by surprise. The other funny part too is, how do they strike back? By doing the most unmagical thing ever. They do what trees do, which is what we were saying. Like, they grow and they're super strong. Now, you get adds a little spice that they can walk around and are intelligent, you know, have consciousness, and then they can, what usually would take them 100 years, they can do in 5 seconds, right? But still, I mean, that's cool. Like, that's fun. But that's not like superpowers. It's not like he had to give them some new power or some creative thing. He's just leaning into how trees normally are, right?
Right. It's the implication is that if Saruman wasn't actively spreading his evil across this fortress and across this landscape, that in 100 years, weeds and little things growing up out of the cracks in the stones would have destroyed it the way that the Ents just destroyed it.
Right.
Which
I
think is kind of cool. It's like, it's cool and interesting. Like, for all the stuff we build, nature will take it back over if we're not actively kind of forcing it into being.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so at this point, afterwards, phase two of recalling things that have happened. Mm-hmm. Or maybe this is phase three. I don't know, whatever. Ents, they start hatching a new plan, but they're going to keep a stealthy good watch on Isengard. Merry and Pippin hang out all day looking for something to eat. At dusk, typical hobbits. Oh my God. Okay, at dusk, Treebeard comes up to them. And then Pippin asks if he's tired.
Tired, he said? Tired? Well, no. Not tired, but stiff. I need a good draft of Entwash. We have worked hard. We have done more stone cracking and earth gnawing today than we have done in many a long year before. But it is nearly finished. When night falls, do not linger near this gate or in the old tunnel. Water may come through, and it will be foul water for a while, until all the filth of Saruman is washed away. Then Isen can run clean again. He began to pull down a bit more of the walls, in a leisurely sort of way, just to amuse himself.
We were just wondering where it would be safe to lie and get some sleep when the most amazing thing of all happened. There was a sound of a rider coming swiftly up the road. Merry and I lay quiet, and Treebeard hid himself in the shadows under the arch. Suddenly a great horse came striding up, like a flash of silver. It was already dark, but I could see the rider's face clearly. It seemed to shine, and all his clothes were white. I just sat up, staring, with my mouth open. I tried to call out, and couldn't. There was no need. He halted just by us and looked down at us. Gandalf, I said at last, but my voice was only a whisper. Did he say, "Hello, Pippin, this is a pleasant surprise"? No, indeed. He said, "Get up, you tomfool of a took. Where in the name of wonder in all this ruin is Treebeard? I want him quick." Treebeard heard his voice and came out of the shadows at once. And there was a strange meeting. I was surprised, because neither of them seemed surprised at all. Gandalf obviously expected to find Treebeard here, and Treebeard might almost have been loitering about near the gates on purpose to meet him. Yet we had told the old Ent all about Moria. But then I remembered a queer look he gave us at the time. I can only suppose that he had seen Gandalf or had some news of him, but would not say anything in a hurry. "Don't be hasty," is his motto, but nobody, even the elves, will say much about Gandalf's movements when he is not there.
"Whom, Gandalf," said Treebeard, "I am glad you have come. Wood and water, stock and stone, I can master, but there is a wizard to manage here."
"Treebeard," said Gandalf, "I need your help. You have done much, but I need more. I have 10,000 orcs to manage." Then those two went off and had a council together in some corner. It must have seemed very hasty to Treebeard, for Gandalf was in a tremendous hurry, and was already talking at a great pace, before they passed out of hearing. They were only away for a matter of minutes, perhaps a quarter of an hour. Then Gandalf came back to us, and he seemed relieved and almost merry. But he said he was glad to see us then. "But Gandalf," I cried, "where have you been? And have you seen the others?"
"Wherever I have been, I am back," he answered in the genuine Gandalf manner. "Yes, I have seen some of the others, but news must wait. This is a perilous night, and I must ride fast. But the dawn may be brighter, and if so, we shall meet again. Take care of yourselves, and keep away from Orthanc. Goodbye."
Okay, so that was fun. So Ent's plan is to flood the place. Gandalf's return. Pippin did a pretty good job of recalling that, I'd say. That's a good lines about from Tolkien. "Wherever I've been, I'm back." That was a good line, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so then Merry and Pippin talk about how the Ents are going to break the dam and pour water into Isengard. They had to climb onto some high arch to avoid all the water. Then it's been flooding for a day at this point. Then they remember to talk about Wormtongue, because it sounds like he came in the morning of their retelling of all this. And that was a pretty funny story, but you guys can go read it yourselves. And with that, we're actually already about to the end of the chapter, except we gotta address it before we forget. Do you know what Flotsam and Jetsam is, the name of the chapter?
Ooh, good one. This is like a crossword puzzle thing.
Dude, also, can I say my story?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so I remember the first time I read this, it was probably, I was in high school, so it was 2010. So obviously I didn't have I guess there were iPhones by that point, but I wasn't rich, so I didn't have one for sure. So I couldn't look this up on like a phone, you know, and Google searches were not as good as they are now 10 years later. So I remember looking this up, and all that came up when I would search Flotsam and Jetsam was just Lord of the Rings Cliff Notes you know, chapter Cliff's Notes to just explain it. And so I didn't actually know what this was for a while, but I figured it out now. But what do you got?
I definitely remember knowing what this was at some point in time, but I'm going to take a stab here. I know that both together, this is like the stuff floating around after a ship crashes, like an old pirate ship washes up on a reef.
Yeah.
And one of them, I think, is the stuff that washes up on shore, and one of them is the stuff that keeps floating around in the water and doesn't wash up on shore.
Mm. Yeah, I just learned it was the nautical term for the crap. I think, actually, but it might be...
I can't remember which one's which, and...
It might be specifically the stuff that's floating around that is now completely useless.
Oh, interesting.
There might be something where the other stuff is still... the important stuff is not part of the flotsam and jetsam. But
okay.
I didn't look into it enough, but that might be a thing. Also, just want to remember too, these ends. What do you think this destruction feels most like? War zone? What? Factories that's blown up.
It's a good question. Flooded. It's like the flooded fortress. I don't know. I guess I associate it. First of all, with a flood, because flood is like, seems like it has its own genre of destruction where things are like really calm afterwards, but like all the buildings are just wrecked and there's like water and garbage floating everywhere.
Yeah, I think to fit with the natural theme, like nature striking back, I would say this feels like a hurricane.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so then at this point, that's the story. I think they just kind of say, like, yep, that's it. We're caught up. Like, literally, I think. I forget. But then, yeah, they just look for the rider's food. And then Aragorn thinks more about the Longbottom leaf from the South Farthing that is now in Isengard. Mm-hmm. And then what does Aragorn say? You want to take that?
Sure. Can I interject briefly? I actually, while we were talking, I looked up Flotsam versus Jetsam. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, and I was wrong. It's not like what gets washed up on the beach versus what stays in the water. The Flotsam is the stuff that's like when the ship crashes, that is the debris floating around, aka the real cargo.
Yeah.
The Jetsam is the stuff they throw overboard, maybe in distress, but like the less important stuff to lighten the load of the ship. I'm thinking like jettison versus like floating wreckage, something like that.
Okay.
Anyway.
Interesting. Yeah. So Aragorn, though, he's considered about the Longbottom leaf. You want to read his quote?
"The more I consider it, the more curious I find it. I have never been in Isengard, but I have journeyed in this land, and I know well the empty countries that lie between Rohan and the Shire. Neither goods nor folk have passed that way for many a year, not openly. Saruman had secret dealings with someone in the Shire, I guess. Worm tongues may be found in other houses than King Theoden's. Was there a date on the barrels?"
"Yes," said Pippin. "It was the 1417 crop. That is last year. No, the year before, of course, now. A good year."
"Ah, well, whatever evil is afoot over now, I hope, or else it is beyond our reach at the present," said Aragorn. "Yet I think I shall mention it to Gandalf, small matter though it may seem among his great affairs."
Ooh. So,
once again, Aragorn's got a little side suspicion that something weird's going on, just as he felt before. I mean, Aragorn's always got his finger on the pulse.
Yeah, he's on top of stuff. Yeah,
but he seems to feel like this is pretty weird that there's goods from the Shire in the storerooms at Isengard, even though there's no official trade route. It means something's afoot.
Yeah.
So he's very clever, certainly, to spot that.
Foreboding.
Definitely. Small matter, though it may seem.
I think that's all I got.
Okay, great.
Yeah, sweet. Good. We kept one short. All right, we're back again.
Indeed we are.
Okay, Clifford, we'll ask how you're doing later, but No. We got a plan for this ending.
Oh,
so
man.
We've neglected to talk about the actual Tower of Orthanc itself. Reasons being, there was a lot of like 5 pages of the drafts went over the evolution of that tower. Uh-huh. And every time I got to it, I just put the book down, didn't touch it. And then I finally was like, well, actually, you know what? Because we've already finished the chapter that comes out after this, mm-hmm. where they go up to the tower. And I thought, well, we shouldn't just neglect it, but we're not going to talk about it there. So I'll just push it off to Clifford to tell us about it. So what do you got?
Well, I will say, it seems like from the descriptions in the drafts that you sent, they did a pretty good job in the movie.
You think so? Wait, did it not look like that fifth version? That fifth version doesn't look like it.
I guess I should temper that. In the drafts, for those of you who haven't seen these, this is what Patrick sent me, there's actually a handful of sketches that Tolkien did with different versions, different incarnations of what the Tower of Orthanc looks like, which is super cool to see him kind of thinking it out and describing it. And there's little similarities that come across a bunch of them, and then also ways that they change. But the one you're saying, number 5, is like the most official one, and that doesn't look like what they did in the movie. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Is it the most official? I kept glancing at those pages. I can't remember.
It's hard to say exactly from what he's saying. He's like, there's different incarnations of it. It seems like the fifth one is the final one, but there's like language references throughout. I don't know that there is a final version.
Okay, well, are you gonna tell us anything cool, or are you just gonna say the movie did good?
I'm trying to set the scene for people.
Oh, sorry that I'm interrupting.
No worries. Anyways, like big, super severe dark stone, almost like a landform, like it's made out of dark rock. One thing that I had is like, it's kind of a castle, but it's got like the aesthetic of, you know, Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland. You ever seen photos of that? You should look it up. It's
one second.
Okay. Giant's Causeway
I've seen pictures of that.
Anyway, super dramatic.
It's like, yeah, it's stones. It looks like kind of columns, but in like a pack.
Right, and it's like this hexagonal formation. Super cool to begin with, but it's that type of like severity is what I imagine kind of Tolkien being inspired by. Other funny, or obviously this is way after Tolkien's time, but two things that came to mind with this like triangular, super severe looking thing, especially the spike at the top, is the London shard of glass is a, if you search like the shard London, it's a skyscraper that was built like 5 or 10 years ago.
Okay.
But it looks super similar to one of Tolkien's sketches, which is funny, including the 3-part spike up at the top where...
Yeah, well, besides the obvious that it's glass.
Yes, exactly.
Which is almost the exact opposite.
Right. That is, the scale that is mentioned in the books, it sounds like in one of the descriptions, this thing was like 1,000 feet tall. And then alternately, he describes it as being 300 feet tall and then bumps it up to 500 feet tall. So that's like, I mean, for context, 1,000 feet tall would be like a pretty decent tall skyscraper in Chicago. And then 300 feet tall is still like a 20 to 30 story building. So super, super big. Other, I think, just mental references is, you know, Mont Saint-Michel?
Yeah.
That's like way less steep and like severe and much kind of happier looking, but very similar imagery in terms of like this circular castle thing that like slowly builds up with a point right at the center.
Clifford, hold the phone.
What?
You've said Mont Saint-Michel, but I already know there's another building or place that we will meet that potentially has similarities to this one. So,
well, I'll temper that by saying I know what you're talking about, but Tolkien's sketches suggest this kind of tiered thing is a recurring theme. These like
rings, you do know what I'm referring to,
like concentric rings, each one getting a little bit taller. And then let's see, Tower of Babel is obviously, we don't know what that looked like, but that's There's a lot of, like, artistic and historical...
Clifford, stuff. That one we're not going to do until we get to Bardur.
Okay, I'm just saying, there's also some parallels. Like, Tolkien had this in mind, even if it wasn't meant to be, like, a direct reference.
Well, I was just saving Tower of Babel until Bardur, because we already know that this one's based off Bardur. Like, this is the cheap imitation. Remember, we've gone over that?
Mm-hmm.
But
what's holding these things together is, like, kind of brutal looking masonry, and the fact that it's like a cross between a building and a landform, like a piece of rock sort of. Mm-hmm. And then also that it's the landscape around it is shaped to like come up to meet it. In some of Tolkien's sketches he shows like it's a little steep hill and then there's a tower built on top of that,
right?
So it's like with a lot of other things in Lord of the Rings, that the landscape and the thing are one and the same.
Yeah, that was like Gondolin. Like Gondolin's built on, like it's on a rock that's in the middle of a, you know, the Ring of Hills.
Right.
But then the city's built on the huge rock too.
Right. Yeah. Right. Anyways, it's kind of fun to imagine different things like this. Apparently, it seems like people in different parts of the world at different times built circular fortresses. That's not that crazy. Apparently, the Vikings did. A handful of, you can just like search photos of circular fortresses to see some different examples. Obviously a lot of them are just like ruins, but that's kind of what I imagine Isengard being a really, really big version of the same thing. And then this is a little harder to describe, but the ring around the outside, let me think of what an ideal. Okay, I'm not finding a perfect example, but if you search stuff for like ancient walled cities, you can, and it looks like Jericho might actually be a good example, which is
cool. Oh yeah, of course.
You can see examples of how they used to build walls. Like it's not like we normally think of being a castle. Like the wall ran around a huge portion of the city. And so the castle might have been right in the middle, but then there's concentric rings, and then at some point, like people would live inside the wall. The wall would be thick enough that it actually had rooms and stuff inside of it that people would live in. And then, you know, maybe if you're like a poor farmer, you live outside the wall or like in a little shanty attached to it or something. But that living inside the wall, like the really thick wall that's almost like a building itself, is definitely what they describe for ringing around Isengard. Like it's surrounded by this fat, sort of a fat circular track. Which is pretty cool. So, anyways.
Yeah. Fun fact, cities stopped building walls when they made cannons because then they became useless.
Cool.
So, and like Paris definitely had walls and then they just tore them down themselves once cannons were invented, but it wasn't attacked by cannons.
Yeah. Like, I was thinking
they realized they were already useless.
Same thing in Milan. Like, there's still chunks of the old city wall that you can just like walk through in the city. Where it still exists in random little pieces.
There was some cycling town that they went to this year where they specifically were showing, the helicopter was showing pictures. They tore down the walls, but they left the guard towers.
Uh-huh.
So, because, periodically along the wall, you'll have a guard tower. And so that was just sitting now right in the middle of the city because they didn't tear that part down. Because the wall is just obnoxious. It gets in the way, that divides neighborhoods at this point, if it was still there. But they could leave the watchtower. So.
Right. This is maybe better. Oh, never mind. I'm just getting distracted. Tuscan walled cities.
Tuscan walled cities.
Yeah, search something like that. They've got some nice houses inside walls.
Dude, Tuscany.
Yeah.
Siena, super nice. Strada Bianchi.
Okay. That's enough of me rambling about architecture. I think the point is you can imagine. From the movie, the severity of this thing. What's interesting in Tolkien's sketches is that he had ideas of it being round and then made it more sharp, more triangular. Mm-hmm. And then the movie actually showed it as like a four-way, like a cross shape in plan, which is still pretty sharp, but much less like angular knife edge than Tolkien drew himself.
Cool. How else you been?
Been good. It's warm here at last. It's like summer. It's so nice. I left work a little early yesterday, went down to the beach and read for like an hour,
ooh,
which was awesome. I sometimes forget that I live near the beach.
What'd you read?
I guess I was reading the paper primarily.
Lame.
I also read our chapter.
Nice. Dude, listen to this day. Listen to this day. You'll notice I'm in a good mood. But I didn't start out that way. I woke up today and figured, crap, I have no food. I have to go to the grocery store before breakfast so that I can just eat anything. So then I walk out and I drive my car and it keeps turning to the left and I don't know why. And I go like 2 blocks on that and then I pull over and it's like, yep, that is the flattest tire I've ever seen. So I had to put on the spare just to even get it to any sort of shop, because I mean it was so flat. But I felt very accomplished when I put on the spare, and then I crock-potted something all day, so I got to nibble food at that all day and smell it all day, so that was fun. And then when I went to get the flat tire repaired, for some reason the people didn't charge me. I guess that's just what they do at their place. I find that bizarre, but I guess I'll go to them when I need to actually replace the tires. And then, most importantly of all, my day was made when, at the Giro d'Italia, the president of the Make Your Day Club won the race. Peter Sagan, first Giro stage. Such an epic win. It was crazy. I'm in such a good mood. Oh, it was awesome. Yeah.
And for the lay people out there, what is the Makes Your Day Club?
So there's a select few riders where every single time they win, you're just in a better mood the rest of the day, as evidenced by the recalling of my day. Like, there was a couple factors that were picking up the day, but then it went over the top when I saw that Peter Sagan won. Oh, it was so awesome. Such a good win. One of his best. Nice. It'll go down. Arguably a top 5 win, and there's been a lot, so, you know, it's pretty good.
Man. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. All right, this has been plenty long, though.
Okay.
All right, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Yep, stay tuned. Thanks, y'all.